was not so much necessarily the financial aspects of it right away. It was, you know, the emotional response from the president. I think it really hurt a lot of people that before providing condolences to the dozens of victims, you know, to the families who lost loved ones, that the first comment he made about it was about forest management. And that was something that I think hurt a lot of fire survivors, even some of whom were, you know, big supporters of his.
Right. I mean, Trump fancies himself an expert in all sorts of arenas. He is currently a virologist and in November 2018 was a forest management expert, doling out advice on Twitter to the governor of California and other state level officials. Well, I want to thank you so much, Danny, for joining us today. Is there a website for the book?
Yeah, you can go to fireinparadisebook.com for more information about the book and where it can be purchased.
We'll post a link to that from our website later as well. Thank you so much, Danny. Good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My guest has been Danny Anguiano, writer for The Guardian, who covered the Paradise Fire. She was formerly a reporter for the Chico Enterprise Record, where she covered Butte County, including Chico and Paradise. And we've been discussing the new book she co-authored with her colleague at The Guardian, Alistair G. It's called Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we're going to take a look at some of the work being carried out by indigenous movements in the deserts of Southern California to preserve their lands, resources, and cultural heritage. Present-day development is further threatening their sacred sites and ecologically significant areas. And today, an estimated 200,000 Native Americans continue to live in California, limited to reservations that represent less than 5% of lands that they use historically. And of course, you know, traditional cultural sites and sacred sites are under threat for development, for exploitation, for what's underneath the ground. And the Native American Land Conservancy came together to protect and restore sacred sites and areas, providing educational programming for Native American youth and the general public, conducting several scientific studies on cultural, biological, and historical resources on sacred lands. And today we are going to spend the hour talking with one of the movers and shakers in the Native American Land Conservancy, but also so many other things in his own right. We'll be talking with Dr. Clifford Travzer, Distinguished Professor of History and Costo Chair in Native American History. So you're going to want to stay with us. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Dr. Anthony Fauci is warning lawmakers that if the country reopens too soon during the coronavirus pandemic, it will bring needless suffering and death. Fauci, who is the nation's top infectious disease specialist, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention head, Dr. Robert Redfield, are among the experts set to testify to a Senate committee today. In a statement to the New York Times, Fauci warns that officials should adhere to federal guidelines for a phased reopening, including a downward trajectory of positive tests or documented cases of coronavirus over 2 weeks, also robust contact tracing, and sentinel surveillance testing of asymptomatic people in vulnerable populations such as nursing homes. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer welcomed the opportunity for the testimony in what Schumer called a fair, open, and truthful setting.
Until now, we've mostly heard from the members of the Coronavirus Task Force through the distorted lens of the White House press conference, where the president often prevents them from answering fully, interrupts their response, or even contradicts their fact-based advice. This will be one of the first opportunities for Dr. Fauci to tell the American people the unvarnished truth without the president lurking over his shoulder. Dr. Fauci, let it rip.
Fauci and the others are testifying via video conference after self-quarantining as two White House staffers tested positive for the virus. The hearing comes as President Trump is pressuring states to reopen. He wrongly claimed at a briefing yesterday that anyone who wants a coronavirus test can get one. He attacked former President Obama and told an Asian American reporter for CBS she should ask China her question. Christopher Martinez reports.
CBS reporter Weijia Zhang asked why Trump keeps comparing America's testing rates to other countries.
Why does that matter? Why is this a global competition to you if every day Americans are still losing their lives and we're still seeing more cases every day?
Well, they're losing their lives everywhere in the world. And maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question, okay? When you ask them that question, you may get a very unusual answer.
Zhang, who is Asian American, asked Trump why he said that to her.
China?
I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question
like
that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
When another woman reporter tried to follow up on Zhang's question, Trump ended the news conference. I'm Christopher Martinez.
Trump spoke as the recorded U.S. death toll from COVID-19 topped 80,000. The U.S. Supreme Court is taking up President Trump's bid to keep his tax, bank, and financial records private. The justices are to hear arguments by telephone in two cases about subpoenas from congressional committees and the Manhattan District Attorney. Rulings against the president could lead to the campaign season release of personal financial information that Trump has kept secret from investigators and the public. Tesla CEO Elon Musk confirms he has restarted his auto assembly line in the Bay Area city of Fremont in defiance of local Alameda County health officials. The plant in Fremont employs 10,000 workers. Musk has called shelter-in-place restrictions fascist and urged governments to stop taking people's freedom. California Governor Gavin Newsom declined to weigh in despite his past action closing Orange County beaches and threatening to withhold emergency funds from defiant counties. Luana Muniz reports.
The governor was asked about Tesla CEO Elon Musk reopening his plant in Fremont in defiance of Alameda County's public health orders for manufacturing plants to remain shut for now. Newsom said he respects Tesla and Musk, but he's leaving it up to the company and the county to come to an agreement.
I have great reverence for their technology, for their innovative spirit, for their leadership, and I have great expectations that we can work through at the county level the issue with this particular county and this company in the next number of days.
Musk is suing the Alameda County Public Health Department to overturn its order. He has also threatened to move his operations out of California. I'm Luana Muniz.
Deadly violence in the Afghan capital Kabul and in the eastern Nangarhar province. In Kabul, unidentified fighters stormed a maternity hospital, setting off an hours-long shootout with the police and killing 14 people, including two newborn babies, their mothers, and an unspecified number of nurses. Al Jazeera spoke to a witness.
The attackers were shooting at anyone in this hospital for no reason. It's a government hospital, and a lot of people bring in their women and children for treatment.
The neighborhood is home to the Shia minority and has been the site of many past attacks by self-styled Islamic State militants. In eastern Nangarhar province, fighters targeted a funeral ceremony in an attack that killed 24 and wounded dozens. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we have a very special show for you on a topic that a lot of people really don't know a lot about. People come from all over the world and all over the nation to visit the California desert region. And so many people are in awe of Joshua Tree National Park, which, by the way, seeing the stars at night from Joshua Tree National Park is really quite something. Also, even Death Valley or even Palm Springs. Palm Springs, of course, now has a reputation for a lot of hipsters going there for the weekends or long weekends and holidays. But not a lot of people know about the original people of the California desert, of the indigenous tribes or nations from that place. So we're going to be talking about that today, and I would like to welcome our guest, Dr. Clifford Trauser.
Thank you, Margaret. I'm so glad to be on your program and to share some of my knowledge and knowledge that I've gained from tribal elders over the course of many years. The desert is
let me tell our audience a bit more about you, though, and we'll have some time to stretch this out a bit.
Okay.
Dr. Clifford Trauser is a distinguished professor of history, Rupert Costo Chair in American Indian Affairs, and in 2018 received the Lifetime Achievement Award from American Indian Historians at the Western History Conference. Now, he was raised in Arizona and born to parents of the Wendat, is that right, Indian?
That's right.
Right, Indian people, and mixed in with some German blood there. He earned a BA and a master's in history at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, where he worked as an archivist in special collections. In 1973, he earned a PhD in American history with a specialty in American Indian history from Oklahoma State University. That same year, he took a position as museum curator with the Arizona Historical Society. And prior to that, he taught American Indian history at Navajo Community College, or Diné College, Washington State University, and San Diego State University. He has served as chair of the Departments of American Indian Studies as well as Ethnic Studies. Since 1991 at UC Riverside, where he is now, he has been director of American Indian Studies, the California Center for Native Nations, and Native American Educational Program. And with all of that, he's found time to publish several books, including Fighting Invisible Enemies, Health and Medical Transitions Among Southern California Indians, Shadows of Sherman Institute, American Indian Medicine Ways, Achimawavi Song, and Comanche Medicine Man. And he also has won several book awards, the Governor's Award, the Wordcraft Circle of Native American Writers, and more. So, you know, that's a lot going on, Dr. Clifford Trauser. All I could say is that we are delighted and very glad that you're able to join us today.
So glad to join you today.
Right.
And share some of my my past and my research with tribal elders, especially learning not just from documents, but learning from people, taking the time to listen and to learn.
That's right. And, I'll have to say that for a lot of people out in the community, that is, you know, we'd like to see more of that kind of collaboration from those who are in the academy. But given your growing up and your interest and connection to all of this, I imagine that all of that inspired you. Or do you want to tell us what inspired you to focus on this area of work?
Well, when I was a child, my family moved to Yuma, Arizona, and my mother was always saying to us, "Remember that that we are guests here, that the people across the river on the Quitson Fort Yuma Reservation, this is their land. And to the south of us were Kokopas. And so I've always been interested in Native American history. And when I went to college, I was surprised from a class that I took in Western American history how important the various tribes were in American history. Because so often, you know, when we take history classes in high school or even in college, Native folks are left out. And I thought, well, gee, I grew up in a very enriched area with a beautiful landscape around the Colorado River. And it was over the years then that I wanted to listen and learn from people, in addition to doing archival work and reading, but to go to the communities and learn. For example, in Yuma, I was on a radio show for a time with Lee Emerson, who was a Quitson elder, and he was a marvelous teacher, a very open and shared. And what I've found over the years, if I show an interest in people's cultures and histories, that they are very forthcoming and sharing, so that they are imparting their knowledge, their way of knowing, not just written documents, but these are from oral traditions that date back thousands of years.
Right, and this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Our guest, Dr. Clifford Trouser, Distinguished Professor of History and Coastal Chair in Native American Studies at UC Riverside. So, Dr. Trouser, I mean, you study, you write quite a lot, and I'd like to talk about at least one of your books a little later in the program. But you are also very deeply involved in the community, in particular the Native American Land Conservancy, but in other aspects of the community. So it seems to me that this isn't merely just an interest or academic enterprise for you, Dr.
No, it's a really a personal journey of learning and growing, and it's contributing back. It's returning the gift that's been given to me through my life here on Earth, my life here in California. I feel an obligation to know and then to share, and that we all should be considering doing community-based work. I know that the tribes, the Mojave tribe, the Colorado River Indian tribe, the Quitsons, Kokopah, and all of these many Indian tribes here in Southern California, they have so much to offer. They have so much knowledge, and so my feeling is that when I have an opportunity to give back, to learn, and then to share, it's an important obligation to do community-based work and to share back.
Certainly.
So often in the past, scholars would only take from tribes. They would go and get information, but not share it back or show how it's going to be used. So when I work and write anything, I return it to the people who shared with me to ensure that I understood what they were sharing, that I got it right, because it's important to not misrepresent the Native tribes.
Right, and their ownership, of course. What I'd like to do now is to go to a clip from and just like you to respond to some of what you hear. And it is Sean Milanovich, who has served on the Native American Land Conservancy Board for a number of years and is actively involved in its Learning Landscapes program. He's also on the board of directors for the Native American Land Conservancy partner organization, Paiashnikin. Let us go to hear from Sean right now.
The need for protection is really extreme, and there's more and more people coming out into the desert, and you know, they're experiencing the desert for the first time, and when they come, you know, they see the beauty of the desert, and sometimes they don't understand how the desert, I mean, you can you know, cut across the desert, and, you know, that trail will be marked, will be left there for years and years to come. And so as these people are coming into the desert, you know, they see these beautiful sites out there, and as you had talked about, Margaret, these cultural sites.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's rock art, and that's really one of the ways that many people see the desert. They see the beautiful rock art, this rock art which has been left behind from the ancient people, the ones that came before us. But, you know, that's just one part of it. These sacred sites, there's sacred caves. I mean, there's places of ancient cemeteries. There's traditional plants out there, and that's a huge part of it, the plants in the desert.
Absolutely.
We're also talking about the animals that come into the desert. Plants and animals are a huge part of native culture. And, you know, the plants and the animals, they're some of the very beginning part of the Nukutim, the first created ones that the Creator put here on this earth. And, you know, their stories.
Yeah.
And these stories are thousands of years old, and we relate some of these stories to specific places that are out on the desert. So we had heard Dr. Cliff, he was talking about Puha and Iba'a, you know, the power that exists. And this power had been created in the very beginning when the world was created. And there's different places or pockets on the landscape where this power exists. And, you know, where the Native American Land Conservancy has this has their preserve, you know, this is one of those pockets. It's a place of healing, and when you go out to this beautiful preserve, I mean, not only are there the natural plants, you have out there, you have pine trees, but and mesquite, but there's this overall bearing presence of evil power, and this is the power that you get when you for healing. And that's the beautiful thing, you know, that we really want to talk about and share with the people. And so we bring people, we bring Native children, Native adults, we bring anybody who really wants to come out. And usually there's a lot of people from the local government offices that hear about it and want to come out. But we like to take people out on these learning landscape trips, and we share the culture. We talk about the plants, the animals, the relationship that the people had with Mother Earth itself. We share songs and stories, and some of these songs, I mean, they're ancient, and they go back thousands and thousands of years. But we retell these stories, we sing these stories, and these stories and songs are, you know, they're all about creation itself and our place here on Earth, and how we can learn from these songs and stories how to take care of ourselves. The bird songs, as we have said, that these songs are thousands and thousands of years old, but these songs, they tell the story of the people of Southern California. And these songs, they talk about the beginning of creation itself, how the earth was created, and then how the people moved on the earth. Once the earth had been created, when the people were placed on the earth, and how the people moved from place to place, and how they settled in different areas. And our elders, they would say, Chem Iba'a Pichem Kuswe Chem Pachmu Huenipa. We get our power from our songs, and the songs bring us energy. They bring us life, and, you know, they go back and they go to specific places on the landscape, and by retelling these stories, we're empowered, and we feel good when we sing these songs. And we sing these songs for healing. When people are sick, we sing these songs. When people need help, we sing these songs. These songs, you know, they even talk about some of the trails on the landscape. And as Cliff was just talking about, you know, the Coyote Hole, it's on a wellhead. This trail, it crosses the landscape from the Colorado River all the way to the ocean, and the Coyote Hole bisects that trail, or the trail bisected this place right here. And over the years, you know, we had Chemehuevi people coming into the area. Kuwait people were using the area. The Serrano people were using the area. And then we get the name. Our elders taught us that the name originally comes from the coyotes that would dig down into the ground to reach water. And so they would call it Coyote Hole. And so that's the name that has stuck today.
Right. Well, that was so rich. And, you know, Dr. Cliff, he called you Dr. Cliff. So Dr. Clifford, I will now call you Dr. Cliff. And I was fortunate enough to speak with Sean Milanovic this morning. And what you just heard was part of that interview. And Dr. Travje, I wanted to share that with our guests and to also have you kind of a breakdown and explain some of what Sean was talking about. He made reference to Coyote Hole. He made reference to you and other people talking about Puha. And all of this is part of your work as well, part of what you do. So break some of that down for us, Dr.
Yes. Well, I'm honored to share because Sean comes from a community of great oral tradition and wonderful song complex, the bird songs. The bird songs are about a time of creation when the people scattered like birds across the landscape. And the trails that we see in the Mojave and Colorado desert and up into the mountains, they were made by the first people. And so that we consider that a sacred space. Some of the trails go into Coyote Hole and come out of Coyote Hole. People came there to mill. There's these milling sites where people would use their pestles to pound acorns and mesquite and create the food for the people. And so these are held in very high esteem because of the spirit people who still go to these places. That's the belief system, that these places are still used by the spirits and that we as human beings have an obligation to protect and preserve such sites and then to teach others about this way of thinking and this way of living with the environment. So as a result of this association with plants, with animals, with places, then the Native American Land Conservancy, many of the tribes in Southern California and the people of Western Arizona and Southern Nevada, they care about these sites and the preservation of them. Many of them are not on reservations. And so how we ask ourselves in 1997, how can we protect these sites? And we felt that we need to acquire lands that are important to Native people and to put them into sanctuaries and then use them as a means of facing historical trauma that all Native tribes have faced in the past. Here in California, in 1851 and 52, there were 18 treaties made with the tribes with huge acreage of reservations. But the Senate of the United States did not ratify these, and the people did not even realize, they did not know that the Senate had not ratified, the President never signed these treaties, and so they had no legal relationship with the United States, and didn't until 1905 when President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, let them know that the treaties were not ratified. So the Native American Land Conservancy and the tribes today are trying to preserve places that are very important to them culturally, and then to teach other folks widely about these places and to have respect for them and to take care of them. So we were fortunate to be gifted the Coyote Hole so that we can take care of it and then teach others about this site.
Right. And tell us, we're going to have to take a station break in a few minutes, but just tell us again the Coyote Hole and the relationship of Coyote Hole with the work of the Native American Land Conservancy. And,
yes.
And dig in a bit about the importance also of Coyote Hole.
Mm-hmm. So it's an important cultural site used by many tribes. So the Kuya people use
And where is it?
Where is it?
And it is located near the town of Joshua Tree, right adjacent to the Joshua Tree National Park on the western side, the northwestern side of Joshua Tree National Park. And it's just a small canyon that runs almost to the park in the town of Joshua Tree. And over the years, people had gone in there and had spray painted the rock art. They had created fires, and so a lot of the rocks were scarred. They had dumped trash into the area. Mm. So our job has been to go in and clean up this site. And then, of course, this just happened in 2018. So in the near future, we will take people to this site, including people living in Joshua Tree, people, not just Native people, but all people, to teach them about why this is so important, not just to Native Americans, but also important to all people because of our relationship with such places of power on the earth. The Kuya call it Iva, and the Southern Paiute people call it Puha. And the Puha is a place of power in it, and we believe that power sits in places, and that if you go to that place with a good heart and a good mind, you too can feel the power of the place, and it can help you, whether you have a disease or whether you're affected by historical trauma or whatever negative feelings are inside of you, you can benefit by going to these places. Yeah. And so the Native American Land Conservancy takes people to these sites and teaches them.
Oh, how wonderful. That's really wonderful. I just wanted to hear more, but of course we're going to hear more when we return from station break. And then we will continue our discussion with Dr. Clifford Travser. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Sojourner Truth. If you are on Facebook, like and friend us, please, on Facebook. And we're also on SoundCloud. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we'd like to give a shout out to all of our listeners in the deserts of California. That is a shout out. And also internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to all of the migrants who are on the Mexico side of the Mexico-U.S. Border being denied access to come into land to which they also have an indigenous connection. We are having a special today, an in-depth discussion with our guest, who is very much an expert on Native American history. It's Dr. Clifford Travser, Distinguished Professor of History, the Rupert Gosto Chair in American Indian Studies. In 2018, he received the Lifetime Achievement Award from American Indian Historians at the Western History Conference, and he has written a book on the Chimawavi. He's written several books on, and one in particular that I'm going through now on the Chimawavi. So, Dr. Clifford Travser, before we took station break, you used language to describe a relationship of people with the land, of people with places of power called the Puha by some of the nations. And, you know, some of our listeners, and talking about these places, a place of healing, right? And mm-hmm. I wondered it really expresses a somewhat different relationship with the land, with the environment, with Mother Earth itself that we find not only out in the desert, but from what I could gather from in terms of indigenous peoples, that seemed to be something that's there, whether it's the Aboriginal people in Australia or the desert tribes of Southern California. Tell us a little bit about that, because it's a kind of a world view that some people have to wrap their minds around.
Margaret, you are absolutely correct that indigenous people around the earth, whether we're talking about Africa, the Pacific Islands, the original people of Japan, or the Philippines, Native Americas, all of Native America, the Native universe, that the people have a special relationship with different sites on the earth, places of power that came there at the time of creation. And so these are not fish tales that grow with the telling. This is history to Native Americans and to the indigenous peoples of the world. For example, the Chumwebi Southern Paiute people believe that Ocean Woman fell from the sky, and this woman then began using her body to spread out over water to create the solid earth. And so when we say Mother Earth, and when they say Mother Earth, they're talking about Ocean Woman, who created all these spaces and places. And then at the same time, the belief is that there was, from this other world, an energy force, a network that is both like a net, but it is also like a spiral. You know, that the spiral webs that spiders create, mm-hmm. that some of that is in certain places. So there's power everywhere in a relationship, but certain places have a great concentration of power.
Right. That you're explaining it very well, and I'm wondering I know my daughter is a physicist, but she's not a string theorist. She's not a stringy, more classical. But I wonder how people who are string theorists would think of what you just said about basically describing this kind of web. But it's also interesting that in other cultures, you talk about this woman, right? You know, I know in some places people talk about beautiful shell woman. Certainly in West Africa, and a lot of people who came over enslaved from West Africa, and they talk about Yemenja, right, who is connected also with the oceans and the water. So it's interesting that you can see in some of these indigenous cultures, not exactly the same story, but a similarity in the story of a woman connected to water. And I just read something this morning about the discovery on, I think it's an asteroid, of elements of water, you know, one of the space station or one of the information coming back from space has showed us this. And of course, people are saying, well, or the theory is that some of this also came to Earth. So there are many ways of telling that story and looking at that story. But tell us then, you mentioned the bird songs, and you also, there's been, I know when I first met you out in the California desert, and a lot of the desert tribes had gathered, and at the Oasis of Mara, which is in 29 Palms, and that's where the 29 Palms Inn is based now, and that was where the Chimawavi and others gathered. So tell us about the significance of the bird songs. Sean talked a bit about them, but also about the salt songs. Like, what are they, and what is the significance of the salt songs?
Right. Well, both of them are a sacred complex of songs. The birdsongs are sang today throughout Indian country of Southern California. It's a shared song complex of the Kuya, the Serrano, the Kumeyaay, Mojaves, Chemehuevis. Multiple people sing the birdsongs, and they talk about the scattering of people to different places. Now, we're talking about the scattering of people, meaning the Nukutum for Kuya, meaning they're like the first people, the first beings on Earth, establishing themselves and wandering across the desert. They would meet an animal, for example, the badger. And so they created a song about the badger. It's one of my favorite songs. And if Sean was here with us, he could sing that song. Mm-hmm. But this is a living song complex that's still very much alive. And it's been people like Sean Milanovic who has really reached out and learned the songs and then reached out to teach young people all over Kuya country. And this is true of the Kumeyaay, the Luseno people, multiple tribes, reclaiming their songs and singing them and then sharing them. The salt songs are southern Paiute songs. They're different than the songs sung by the Kuya and others. And they are a sacred complex so that people could be guided to Paiute heaven, if I can use that word. But at the beginning of time, it was believed that Coyote happened to notice that when people died, that their spirits stayed on Earth. And he felt that there needed a place, a special place for the spirit people to go. And so he talked to his brother, the wolf, about this, and they created a hole in the sky. Up above Las Vegas, there's this hole in the sky that then they needed to guide people to this place where they could ascend into heaven. And so they placed a body of songs in a cave in western Arizona.
Wow.
And two women, and women are so important. Ocean Woman was the creator, and these women receive the power in the songs, and they begin the first journey of the salt songs that travel over 1,000 miles. And what happens is when the people sing this song complex today, by midnight they sing the cry song. And it indicates a place in the song complex where the two women, the two sisters, have to split. And one represents going on to the other world, and the other one represents us here on Earth, that we stay alive and we must continue. And the cry song then is when these two sisters part. And the second half of the songs that go all night long from midnight until early morning at sunrise is to bring that other woman back into California, down through the Oasis of Mara to Palm Springs, and then east to the Colorado River, north to the Riverside Mountains, and then she crosses back into Arizona about where the Colorado River Indian Reservation is today, travels north, and returns to that cave, Tingaye.
Wow.
And so they sing about this, and it's just a beautiful song complex, and it's singing their people into the other world.
Right. And again, our guest here is Dr. Clifford Trabzer, who is Distinguished Professor of History and the Rupert Costo Chair in American Indian Affairs. He is at UC Riverside, and this is the host of Sojourner Truth, Margaret Prescott. And we're having an in-depth conversation, really the first that we've had to talk about the Native people of the California desert region, their attempts to explain sacred sites, to protect those sites, and also to protect the land. What I would like to do now is to talk a bit about, because we know about all the disenfranchisement, et cetera, that has happened with indigenous people, you know, just internationally, really. But before I get to that, I wanted just if you have a sense of how old some of these songs are, like the salt songs. And I understand also that they're not public. This is not something, you know, songs that I would get on the air and play. And now we're going to play some salt songs, right? So Just tell us, though, some of that. Like, how far back does this stuff go? And also the work that you all are doing with the Native American Land Conservancy, but also Native elders throughout the region, you know, California and Arizona, et cetera. You know, to the work that they're doing to preserve this knowledge, to preserve this culture, and to preserve this knowledge of these parasites. Dr. Cliff.
Right. Well, the people, both Kuia, the Kumeyaay, all of the people, and including Southern Paiutes, would say that we can't think in linear time about how many thousands of years ago.
Oh.
They're just ancient, and that since the time immemorial, at the beginning of time, as things were forming on the earth, when the water is receding, the earth is being created, trees are emerging, all of the plants, the various animals, and they're given names, that this is a time just at the beginning of being. Hmm. For the various tribes, and every tribe has these origin narratives, which also are considered sacred. You know, they don't go around sharing this these songs and these creation stories willy nilly, because a lot of people feel that they're fish tales that grow with the telling.
Hmm.
That's what one response from a book that I submitted to the University of Oklahoma, that some outside reviewer said that, and I thought, these are sacred pieces of knowledge that only the indigenous people know, and if you're gifted by them, you need to use them carefully and share them as accurately as possible. So what I've done is I always ask my students to please consider, how do you know what you think you know? And the things I know about the school songs comes from Mr. Larry Eddy, an elder on the Colorado River Indian Reservation, and Matt Lavis as well. But these are singers. These are elders who decided that they would share with me. So on March the 5th, 2016, I sat all day with Mr. Eddy, and he wanted me to write this down, and he kept telling people at this conference, I want you to know this. I don't want you to forget this. This is who we are. And so he shared deeply about the salt songs with me, and knew I was working on this project. And then we lost Mr. Eddy.
Mm-hmm.
So when I wrote this small piece about Pua, then I sent it to the Colorado River Indian Reservation, to the museum, to Willene Fisher, who shared it with Mr. Eddy's family. And Matt has done the same thing to make sure that, okay, is it time to share some of this knowledge now?
Yeah.
And people are opening up, because it's a way of reclaiming their songs, their power, their history, and sharing it with others, saying, this is legitimate. This is the way we think, which might be different than the way other historians think about the past.
Yeah.
But the past doesn't begin with written language. The past and history begins with the creation.
Right. And on that note, I'm going to play another clip from a film called Doctrine of Discovery, and then including an elder, and then a brief piece from Tom Goldtooth, who is with the Indigenous Environmental Network, a different part of the world from where you are, you know, Tom, being out in the Plains area. But just quickly before I play that clip, what you said about the beginning of time and these songs, I mean, it seemed like it was a kind of a map of a certain kind, or maps of a certain kind, to me in song. And it reminds me that Aboriginal people in Australia They also have a way, but in stories, I think, in telling a story that's also a map that helps the people to not only get around in practical ways, but also that kind of relationship that we still don't fully understand between people and the ancestors, people and those who have, you know, gone on before. And I also remember some of the Aboriginal people in Australia near the oceans, that some of their art actually reflect a map of the ocean floor, which when I found that out and it was explained to me, it's like, how is that possible, right? So there's a lot that we don't understand, Dr. Cliff, and we appreciate what you're sharing with us now to help us to understand that. I don't know if you had a quick comment on any of that before I go on to the clip.
Yes. Well, our people here, our indigenous people throughout California, Arizona, Nevada, all had map phones. And Larry Eddy told me that when he was a child, he traveled with his grandfather and his uncle into the Mojave Desert, and his grandfather was singing the map songs. Now he, that is Mr. Eddy, did not know them, but he said they knew them, and it took them from one water place to the next as they were doing some hunting in the Mojave, and then they came back. So when I was doing a research project with the Mojaves, I asked Michael Soucy, well, you know, you all had these songs as well. Does anybody sing them? And he says, oh, you know, we lost them long ago. It's like not being able to go there anymore because the government would not allow us to hunt and gather away from our reservation, and we would be in jeopardy and could be put in prison for that.
Wow.
And so if you don't use the map, you don't need the songs. And so it has been lost. Now, there may be people in other tribes who remember those songs. I just haven't met them.
Right, right. Okay. Well, let's go to that clip now, and then we are going to continue our discussion.
Love your life. Perfect your life. Beautify all things in your life. Seek to make your life long and its purpose the service of your people. Prepare a noble death song for the day when you go over the great divide. Always give a word of salute when meeting or passing a friend, or even a stranger when in a lonely place. Show respect to all people and grovel to none. When you arise in the morning, give thanks for the food and for the joy of living. If you see no reason for giving thanks, the fault lies only with yourself. Abuse no one and nothing. For abuse turns the wise ones into fools and robs the spirit of its vision.
Over 95% of our body is water. And in order to stay healthy, you've got to drink good water. When the European first came here, Columbus, we could drink out of any river. If the Europeans had lived the Indian way when they came, we'd still be drinking out of water, because the water is sacred. The air is sacred. Our DNA is made of the same DNA as the tree. The tree breathes what we exhale. When the tree exhales, we need what the tree exhales. So we have a common destiny with the tree. We are all from the earth. And when the earth, the water, the atmosphere is corrupted, then it will create its own reaction. Mother is reacting.
With the bringing together in unification, and that's one of the things that our elders throughout Turtle Island, North America, have told us, is that we have to come together. We have to strengthen our sacred hoop. That we have to establish these confederacies of unification and treaty between our elected tribal governments, our tribal programs, our grassroots indigenous peoples, our traditional practitioners, our spiritual leaders, and our youth, because we work together, and especially our women's societies. Our foundation is based upon our women and our voice of our grannies, our aunties, our sisters, and our daughters and granddaughters.
The violence against the land that we're seeing in our traditional territories, whether it's in Northern Alberta in Treaty 8 or right here in Puyallup and Nisqually territories in Washington State, is violence against Mother Earth. And Mother Earth is a feminine entity, and women as life givers and water keepers, we feel those impacts first and foremost. And we see violence against the land as violence against women.
Alrighty, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Dr. Clifford Travzer. Now, Dr. Cliff, you know, just putting that together first, you heard an elder talking about how you live your life and a respect for all and giving thanks and abusing no one, not abusing anything, and about all of us, and then an elder talking about 95% of us, of our bodies are water, and the mistreatment that has happened over the years with water. And I was interested when he said that our DNA is the same as a tree. So we have a common destiny with a tree. And, of course, Tom Goldtooth then talking about coming together and unifying and strengthening the sacred hoop. And just in the few minutes we have left, I wanted you to comment on that, on what you just heard, but also relate that to some of the challenges some of the desert tribes are facing right now. There was the Agua Caliente Band and the Coachella Valley Water District problems with windmills and impact on tribal life and wildlife. So first start with your reaction to that, and then some thoughts on the challenges right now.
Yes. You know, what Tom is talking about is the interrelationship of all animate and inanimate things on Earth, that we are all related. And the medicine people I've known over the years have said to me, you know, we are human. We might have different cultures and belief systems, but we are all connected. We are all human beings. And we need to respect the plants, the animals, the places, and not do them harm. If we live a life only for the gaining of money and to get ahead, to have more money than somebody else, we've placed ourselves, our humanity, in jeopardy, because we've forgotten that relationship with the plants, the animals, and the places on Earth. We've forgotten our relationship with each other. And what was said is that when you meet somebody else, you should recognize the humanity in them, your relationship with every other person on Earth, whether they're your friend or possibly an enemy, that still they are part of the human family. I remember too, I once had an injured throat, and I was at a Native American Heritage Commission meeting, and a tribal elder, Catherine Sobel, said to me, when we get back to Banning, I'm going to cure your throat. And I had gone through months of seeing medical doctors. So we got to her home, and she says, I want you to go down into the desert, get away from the highway, and go up to the creosote bush. And you tell that bush you're having trouble with your throat and having trouble speaking, and that you want to use some of its body to heal me, you know, to heal you. And so I clipped off the creosote. I came home. I followed her directions. I made the tea. And I took the tea, and I felt like there was a war in my throat taking place. And then by Monday, just in three dosages of the creosote tea, I was able to speak again. And then she said to me, you make sure that you thank the plant again, and you either burn the plant or you bury it, but you give thanks. And that's the reciprocity that Tom was talking about, that you will hear from tribal elders, that we have an obligation to give back, to return the gift, and to be thankful for what we are given.
Well, that is just something. And, you know, I've seen the creosote bush out in the desert, and there's so much healing knowledge also that we don't know and that we need to know. So tell us about some of the challenges in maintaining these lands and these sacred sites.
Right. I would say the biggest threat to sacred lands
in the deserts and in the mountains is mining, as well as energy projects, very large energy projects, putting in solar energy and wind energy. And the wind machines often will kill birds. They will kill eagles and hawks and all kinds of birds. But also in putting them out in the middle of the desert, it's destroying cultural resources, it's destroying trails, and it destroys plant life. I was with the same Catherine Sobel once as we were traveling near Palm Springs, where all the windmills are, and she said, "Cliff, you see out there? That is where we used to come and gather every year. We would gather the fruit from the barrel cactus, and we loved to come here, and we had such fun. But when they put in these wind machines, they brought in bulldozers, and they leveled everything and destroyed every one of those plants. And we're no longer allowed to go there, even if there were barrel cactus."
Yeah.
So the people have lost their native foods. And with the loss of native foods, then comes disease. It makes their bodies susceptible because the diet, the present modern-day diet,
yeah,
of native folks is not what they grew up eating in. And biologically, for thousands of years, eating a particular type of diet, and then it's changed so radically,
yeah,
it just opens up the body to infection.
Absolutely. And of course, I'm looking at the clock here, and we're going to have to do a part two of this because we literally are out of time. And I know you have said you are not that people are against solar energy, but just taking care,
right,
where they are placed. I can't believe the time has flown. We are out of time. Would you believe this? So will you join us again, and we just continue this conversation?
And I would be honored.
And also, I'm hoping that Sojourner Truth team will be able to come out to the desert sometime soon and meet with you and some of the elders and get more of these stories to share with our audience in Southern California and in other parts of the country. So we hope that would be possible.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Clifford Chavzer. And I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer Ramiro Funes, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our engineer. If today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for joining us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO
Portland.
Always on the outside, always looking in.